insurgency against the Indian rule in Kashmir dates back to the late 1980s. Many militant groups have been active in the valley, in the Kashmir Valley, for the past three decades, fighting the Indian forces. But in recent years, there has been a remarkable shift, especially since the killing of a young militant commander, Burhan Wani, in 2016. There's more local youth joining this movement, and notably, most of these have been educated with promising future ahead of them. But they choose to take up arms because they felt there was no option, no other option. The resistance movement becoming homegrown, becoming indigenous, is a fact acknowledged today by the radical Indian voices too. Indian Prime Minister Modi justified his decision of abrogating Article 370, the special status for Kashmir, 2 years ago, saying it was stoking militancy. But if we look at the records from 2019, these 2 years, the militancy has not only carried on, but it has intensified, even as counterinsurgency operations have also gained pace. According to some reports, official reports, around 2,200 militants are presently active in Kashmir, and majority of them are locals. And in the last 6 months alone, more than 880 militants, as per the official record, have taken up arms against the Indian rule in Kashmir. So numbers surely don't lie. While I would stop short of attributing this surge in militancy to the August 5 decision taken by the Indian government, because the ultimate goal of these fighters is not reinstatement of Kashmir's special status under the Indian constitution or even statehood. The goal here is freedom from the Indian military occupation. Everyone who knows Kashmir can tell you this thing. But yes, the attempt to dilute the disputed nature of Kashmir, the and attempt to integrate the state in the Indian Union, has definitely provoked the Kashmir's indigenous militant outfits.
Thank you, Mr. Mehdi. Now let's take a break and look how the global media has covered the anniversary of the Article 370 revocation by the Indian government.
The administration of Prime Minister Narendra Modi revoked Article 370 of the Indian Constitution, a 70-year-old provision that had given autonomy to the state of Jammu and Kashmir. The government also introduced a bill to strip the region of statehood and divide it into two parts, both under direct control of the central government. But Mr. Modi, a Hindu nationalist, has campaigned for re-election in part by stoking patriotic fervor against Pakistan. He promised the full integration of Kashmir, a cause which his party has championed for decades, and now he is delivering on that pledge. The controversial move by Prime Minister Narendra Modi's government unleashed widespread unrest and was followed by an increased deployment of troops in India-administered Kashmir, which was already heavily militarized. A strict security lockdown was imposed that lasted over a year, along with a communications blackout and months-long internet shutdown. During the crackdown, more than 100 Kashmiri politicians were arrested, while thousands of pro-autonomy activists were detained. 2 years later, analysts say Muslims living in India-administered Kashmir continue to fear being disempowered and reduced to second-class citizens. The very nature of the decisions taken on August the 5th was aimed at political disempowerment of one dominant community. That's the primary concern of people here.
Welcome back, Mr. Mehdi. Since 2019, the government has altered property rights of locals, triggering widespread suspicion amongst locals that the new laws are part of Modi's scheme to change the demography of India's only Muslim-majority region. Now, my question is, has the government succeeded to promote right-wing Hindutva, and has the Indian government succeeded in creating Hindu settlements there on the model of Palestine in a bid to change the Muslim-majority character of the Himalayan region?
Well, the abrogation of Article 370 to end the special status of Jammu and Kashmir state was a long-standing demand of the Nationalist Hindu Party in Delhi, BJP, which is presently ruling India. One of the main objectives behind this move was to change the Muslim-majority character of the Himalayan region, and by allowing Hindus inland India to come and buy properties in Kashmir Valley. Replicating the Israeli model in Palestine. And Article 370 and Article 35A, which is part of this article, people from outside Kashmir, non-Kashmiris, were not allowed to buy land in Kashmir. But this article, when they revoked this article 2 years ago, everything changed. According to the last census, which was in 2011, the population of entire Jammu and Kashmir state is around 12.5 million, which has increased now. And Muslims comprise around 70% of this population. Since August 5, 2 years ago, 2019, Delhi has unilaterally introduced laws related to law and domicile status, which clearly and emphatically seek to change Kashmir's demography and economically disempower Kashmiris. Scores of Indian Hindus from mainland India have already been given domicile certificates and under this new citizenship law, under which non-Kashmiris are now entitled to jobs and residency in Kashmir, which was otherwise reserved only for the local Kashmiris before this article was revoked. So it's quite clear there were the designs of India's ruling BJP party has in Kashmir, despite all the tall talk about economic progress and social empowerment. So it's clear.
Before we take a break, I would like to thank Mr. Zafar Mehdi for being on the program. Now let's see how people on social media see the situation in Kashmir.
Former Kashmir lawmaker Mohammad Yusuf Tarigami says the abrogation of Article 370 by New Delhi delegitimized the mainstream political space in Kashmir. He was one of the senior pro-India politicians put under house arrest on August 5, 2019. Another tweet is by Satindra Kulkarni. That's an Indian politician and newspaper columnist. Those who believe that measures taken on August 5, 2019 solved the Kashmir issue have fallen victim to propaganda. He asserts that Kashmiris feel hurt, humiliated and betrayed. P. Chidambaram calls the revocation of Article 370 in Kashmir an unconstitutional coup and the desecration of democracy, while expressing solidarity with the people of the troubled state.
Every year, on the early days of Muharram, a great number of Muslims and non-Muslims across the world mark the martyrdom anniversary of Imam Hussein, the third Shia Imam and the grandson of Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon them. Mourners take to the streets for rituals during the first 10 days of the Islamic lunar month to pay their respect and express the unison amongst all Muslim communities in the love for Imam Hussein.
Every year, Shia Muslims, along with a lot of other people around the world, hold mourning rituals during the first 10 days of the Islamic lunar month of Muharram. The mourning ceremonies for Imam Hussein and his companions reach their peak on the 9th day of Muharram, or Taswa, and the 10th day, or Ashura. Ashura marks the martyrdom anniversary of Hussein ibn Ali, Hazrat Imam Hussein, who was martyred in the Battle of Karbala in October 680 AD, or Muharram in 61 AH, nearly 14 centuries ago. The accounts of his heartbreaking martyrdom sent shockwaves through the Muslim world as he was widely seen as a hero who sacrificed his life to challenge the corrupt ruler, Yazid ibn Muawiyah.
Imam Hussein's message is an iconic message. It's a message that crosses all nationalities, all religions, anyone who has a heart beating in their chest can actually appreciate and understand, because there are many aspects, as I said, you know, the martyrdom of his, you know, 6-month-old baby, Hazrat Ali Azhar, or his son, 18-year-old son, Ali Akbar, being martyred, or his brother, Hazrat Abbas, who, you know, was a commander of the army, or, you know, Imam Hussein's friend, coming to join him when he was in his late 80s. So all kinds of fascinating human angles come out of it. Secondly, of course, you know, the viciousness of Yazid's oppression against this small group of people who were standing against the oppressive regime of that time also resonates very well with the current circumstances of what's happening globally, if you like. That's why, I talked about in the historical sense, but if you look at it in the last 30, 40 years, since the advent of the Islamic Revolution in Iran, where Imam Khomeini actually used the iconography of Karbala to motivate the Iranian masses. Similarly, people in the subcontinent and far afield, even in other places, can actually resonate very well that, what is oppression and so on.
Morning of Muharram is an opportunity to unite all Muslims behind the cause of Imam Hussein's uprising against tyranny. In addition to the Indian and Pakistani Muslims, myriads of other ethno-linguistic and religious majorities and minorities of the subcontinent consider Imam Hussein as a symbol of resistance and protest against the oppressive powers.
The people of the subcontinent are no stranger to revolt against imperialism due to their shared history of occupation and exploitation. The Muslim community or any other people who feel oppressed and voiceless can view the mourning of Muharram and Imam Hussein as the great unifier. Imagine what feats of human accomplishment might be possible if India, Pakistan, Bangladesh, and the rest of South Asia act as one body towards feasible solutions for other problems of the Islamic population.
This year's Muharram comes at a time when mourning ceremonies are held under many pandemic-related health protocols amid fears of another devastating wave of the coronavirus. Indoor gatherings are prohibited, while mourners were advised to hold the rituals in open areas such as squares and streets instead of traditional places such as mosques and Husseinias.
If you look at India, Pakistan and Bangladesh, the whole population of that big mass of land, which is also in old historical maps called Barre-Saghir, meaning, a continent in its own right. The population of that region is 1.6 billion, 1.7 billion, out of which about 400 to 500 million are Muslims, 250 million in India, 220 million in Pakistan, and another about 160 odd million in Bangladesh, Muslims I'm talking about. So you're talking about at least half a billion Muslims living in that big landmass. And normally statistics are that between 20 to 25% constitute Shias, if you like. So you're talking about well over 100 million Shias living in the subcontinent, more than Iranian population, and perhaps if you add together the whole of the West Asia, there are more Shias living in the subcontinent than the whole of West Asia. So you can see the numbers are quite huge. So of course, historically, as I said earlier, the impact of Imam Hussein's message has been profound. And of course, historically, a lot of Iranians from Iran during Nadir Shah and subsequently moved to, and I'm not talking about the Parsis who were Zoroastrians who moved to India, but also the followers of the Ahlul Bayt who moved to India over the last 300-400 years. They also bore the custom and the practice of Azadari to the Indian subcontinent. And there are two key places, if you like, in India where the whole Azadari took root. One is Hyderabad Dakkan in the south of India, and the other is Lucknow. These were two princedoms, if you like. Nizam of Hyderabad was a remarkable character, although he came from a Sunni school of thought, but he was a lover of Ahlul Bayt, and he provided a lot of facilities, built a lot of Husseinias, provided educational facilities, and the impact of Azadari was quite profound on the subcontinent.
Members of the mourning congregation stage processions listening to eulogies about Imam Hussein while beating drums as a symbol of remembering the Battle of Karbala. As well as weeping and beating chests, votive cooking or nazri is an integral part of the ceremonies. Nazri foods are served or distributed among the mourners and passers-by.
And that was our episode on the situation in the Indian administered Kashmir 2 years after the controversial revocation of the so-called semi-autonomous status. We also talked about the mourning ceremonies of Imam Hussein, peace be upon him, that are held annually during the first days of Muharram. We shall meet again next week. So till then, take care.
Arabi English Radio, a window to peace of mind and spirituality. You can tune in to Arabi English Radio 24 hours a day. We are with you. Are you with us? Are you with us? Are you with us? This is our voice from the heart of the Islamic Republic of Iran, Arabi English Radio.
Tourism. In the name of God, Salam, and welcome to the 8th episode of our series, Health Tourism. In this episode, we are going to introduce you a well-known hospital in Tehran, the Jam Hospital, and also the Bina Hospital, a well-known specialist eye ophthalmology hospital in the Iranian city of Mashhad, which is active in the International Patient Admission or IPD department. Please stay with us. Mashhad, the capital of Khorasan Razavi province, is the second largest city in Iran. The holy shrine of the 8th Shia Imam, Imam Reza, peace upon him, who is highly esteemed by Muslims, is also located in this city. For this reason, Mashhad is called the spiritual capital of Iran. The presence of the shrine of Imam Ali ibn Musa Reza, peace upon him, and many spectacular historical and recreational attractions has made this city one of the tourist hubs of Iran that annually receives thousands of pilgrims and tourists from all over Iran and the world. The shrine of Imam Reza, peace upon him, is located in the center of Mashhad. Some of the structures of this holy shrine date back before the Safavid dynasty and from the Timurid period, and even before that. But during the reign of Shah Tahmasp Safavid, many activities were carried out to expand the shrine. Therefore, this holy place is considered a large museum of Iranian architecture. In addition to being a pilgrimage city, Mashhad also benefits from many tourist attractions. One of these attractions is Mashhad Stone Mountain Park, which is very old and famous and is one of the most beautiful parks in Iran. This park is a combination of water, stone, greenery, and light. Other historical and scenic places in Mashhad include Malik Historical House, National Garden, Vakilabad Park, Haft Hoz Natural Park, St. Mesrop Church, and the tomb of Nader Shah Afshar. The city of Mashhad, with 2,226 accommodation units and dozens of direct flights to various destinations, is one of the tourism hubs of Iran. This, along with well-equipped hospitals and competent doctors, has attracted thousands of health tourists both from home and abroad to this city. They travel to Mashhad for treatment of various diseases and benefit from its excellent medical facilities. The city is historic, scenic, safe, and well worth a visit. In the remainder of this program, we will introduce you a specialist medical facility in the city of Mashhad, the Bina Eye Hospital, and we will become more familiar with the medical services and facilities offered and its IPD department. Stay with us. Bina Ophthalmology Hospital, with 7 floors, with a base of 9,500 square meters, was inaugurated on September 23, 2018. The hospital has 32 beds, 6 operating rooms, 2 laser operating rooms, and a specialized ophthalmology services. Bina Eye Hospital also has 19 inpatient rooms, of which 5 are single rooms and 14 are double rooms. In this medical center, 6 operating rooms with nano equipment and ophthalmology devices with the latest technology in the world for corneal diseases, cataract, and other eye diseases have been provided. Bina Hospital has made to utilize the experienced ophthalmologists and in order to cure diseases related to the cornea, retina, glaucoma, strabismus and eye aberrations, eye surface diseases, different types of eye and tear duct allergies, DCR, cosmetic eye surgeries, and neuro-ophthalmology, and in other words, all eye diseases, so that the patient does not need to go to other medical centers. One of the departments of Bina Eye Hospital is the International Relations Unit. This unit has been established in order to provide services and increase the satisfaction of foreign patients and their well-being. Due to the high quality of medical services, the low cost of treatment, state-of-the-art equipment, and up-to-date world-class ophthalmologists and physicians, many medical tourists come to this hospital for treatment. These tourists are mostly from Iran's neighboring countries, such as Tajikistan, Republic of Azerbaijan, Turkmenistan, Iraq, Pakistan, and even some European countries such as Sweden and Germany. The International Patients Unit of the Eye Hospital manages and facilitates all matters related to the treatment of foreign patients before the patient enters Iran until their discharge from the hospital. The IPD team of the Eye Hospital is composed of international patient experts, English and Arabic translators, experienced doctors and nurses, and provides the best facilities to patients so that the patient has complete satisfaction during his treatment in Iran. The patient or the health tourist can be admitted to the Eye Hospital either by going to the hospital in person, via phone or online, or refer to the facilitation companies and obtain required information about the cost of treatment in the hospital. The city of Mashhad, with its competent physicians, committed medical staff, and up-to-date and modern equipment, has a large share in the Iranian health tourism industry. Of course, the presence of pilgrims has also been very effective in increasing the health tourism of this city. Bina Eye Hospital, which is a new and well-equipped hospital of its kind, has been very popular among foreign tourists, despite the short time that has passed since its establishment and operation. Dear friends, for more information about Bina Eye Hospital, you can visit the website of this hospital at www.ehbina.org. bina.com or http://ehbina.com/pages/English homepage or call 0098-5136163 and get information on how to admit in this center. The hospital's email is info@ehbina.com, which is, of course, another way to contact Bina Hospital. Dear listeners, that was the 8th episode of our series, Health Tourism. Until our next program, goodbye and God bless. Doc Review.
Hello and welcome to Doc Review with me, Camelia Shambayati. In today's show, we're discussing Gunrunners, directed by Canadian documentary filmmaker Anjali Nayar. And joining me in the studio, we have Lee Singer, who is a film journalist and video essayist whose work has appeared in various major newspapers, magazines, and online outlets. And beside him is Tete Coffey, who is a journalist and broadcaster. Now, Gunrunners, which is shot over a 10-year period, follows two Kenyan cattle rustlers, who are also known as warriors, Julius Urile and Robert Mutanda, who put their violent past behind them to become marathon runners as part of a government-sponsored program to disarm the conflict-heavy region. We see Urile enter international marathons, while Mutanda gets involved in the political sphere and dreams of working towards policy change. Though as we see these once notorious warriors given a chance to pursue their dreams, we realize that the road to glory is full of bumps and detours for these charismatic men. Well, first of all, welcome both of you to the show. Thanks very much for coming on. Now, Kenya is known as a destination for world-class marathon runners, but it's not as glamorous as it seems to be a top athlete in that part of the world, particularly because some of them are quite literally running for their lives, running away from crime, and we see that cattle stealing, or cattle wrestling, as it's called, is quite commonplace because that's an important source of income, and this region is also engulfed in the illegal arms trade industry, which is part of a global multi-billion dollar industry. Lee, if I could start with you as our guest film critic, what was your take on this documentary?
Well, firstly, it's just a fascinating sort of insight into, you know, a situation that I really did not know much about. You know, I know very well that Kenya is a history of producing great runners. I didn't know about this, you know, pretty fantastic government-run program, this sort of amnesty and the disarmament idea, which is a really great one, and obviously it gives a great film title then, Gunrunners. The film itself, I mean, I think it was shot over 10 years, so I, you know, you can only imagine how much footage has been accumulated during that time. And I guess, as fascinating as I found the subject and the two principal characters, I felt that in a sort of 90-minute running time, you're kind of skipping big chunks. You know, so much is going on, and I didn't feel that I was getting to know the two men in the way that I would have liked. I mean, basically, I could imagine a longer film that would I would have maybe, you know, it's longer, but you would have felt more in getting into the rhythm of what's going on with these people, because there's so much to say, and they go through so many changes, both of them individually, and I feel 90 minutes doesn't necessarily do justice to everything that's, you know, it's trying to encapsulate.
You're right, it is absolutely jam-packed. It touches on issues of violence, as well as the main themes of sports and running, but then also politics and corruption. There's just so much in this documentary. And Tete, if I could turn to you, what was your take on Gunrunners?
Okay, normally when I'm told about documentaries about Africa, I yawn, roll my eyes and go, oh God, not again. I tend to want to avoid them. I was very pleasantly surprised by this for two reasons. One, it was rich in context, so that whatever was going through the lives of these two, the protagonists, if you like, it was placed within context and it gave you an understanding of the environment from which they came. Secondly, I think it was done with quite a lot of sensitivity. There's little tricks he used in what you call chopping and changing. I mean, cutting from the Rift Valley, training scenes.
Which is absolutely breathtaking.
Exquisite. In Kenya, over to the skyscrapers of New York. You could see that these are two little people operating in one world, but kind of moving out into a much, much bigger world. And the third thing I really liked about it was that it looks as if these two characters are archetypes. Really is very much the superstar, the very talented runner and so on. And his mate, Matanda, seems to be much more the political type. So how the two characters fare was something I was always watching to see. I was impressed.
I'd like to pick apart their characters a bit later on.
Sure.
Maliv, I'd like to ask you, this documentary kind of describes itself as the American Dream, but Kenyan style. It's an interesting analogy. What are your thoughts on this?
Yeah, I'm always a bit puzzled by this American dream. I don't understand why, you know, one country has a monopoly on wanting to change your life for the better and improve your situation. I mean, it's a cute tagline. I think it's kind of irrelevant. The fact is, yes, they do go to New York and, you know, run marathons there. But, you know, marathon running is a world global pursuit. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, to me, it smacks more of marketing than any sort of reality. Why can't it be a Kenyan dream?
Saturday marks the first annual Tekla Lerupe Peace Race. Tekla Lerupe, the former marathon world record holder from the conflict region, is partnering with the government to invite cattle rustlers to trade in their weapons in exchange for amnesty and a chance to win cows and cash prizes.
We learn from this film that this amnesty program is quite inspirational. How does it transform the lives of Arelia Matanda, Lee?
Well, I mean, you know, until this program comes in, they are very aware that they're living a very precarious, you know, highly dangerous existence, and one that they're very clearly both uncomfortable with. You know, it does involve, they don't answer it directly, but you very much get the sense that they've been involved in deaths. And obviously they've had loved ones or friends die as well. So it's just a really unpleasant, you know, precarious existence. So this government program is really trying to give people a kind of a firmer foothold in, I guess, you know, quote unquote, the right direction. So taking them away from sort of illegal activities, illegal guns, and trying to sort of, you know, push their energies and their sort of, their outlook in a more kind of positive and, peaceful direction. So that's a great thing.
And Tete, the film sheds a positive light on this amnesty program. How effective is it really, and can you talk more a bit about this?
Well, there are a couple of things which come out. For a program to work, you've got to be able to transfer skills which are being adversely used or not constructively used into something which is positive. And in the way the story pans out with these two characters, Matanda is very much the organizer. I mean, he had 500 effectively gangsters, hoodlums, they call themselves rustlers, under his charge. This guy's a people organizer. Of course, he's the one whose skills are now deployed in the political arena, actually getting people involved with the program, even campaigning for a parliamentary candidate. And he says he himself has parliamentary aspirations. Then Arelia, on the other hand, is the rising star, the hugely talented individual. They said that even as a kid, he was winning things at the local level. So his skills, his competitive drive is now being, you know, applied in an arena which can actually make him money, improve the quality of his personal life, the life of his family, and so on. And it does say that a lot depends on the quality of government, the environment you provide. These talents are available in bad neighborhoods, and they're available in the right postcodes. The difference is that in the right postcode or a stable environment, those talents are able to flourish because they are positively deployed. So in terms of this gun amnesty, Kenya had a problem. I think it was a blindingly inspired idea. It's one of the funniest quotes I actually picked up from this was he said, well, the skills I need to run, to chase, to rustle are to chase. I need to be able to run fast to chase cattle, and I need to be run fast to escape the police. And he's doing that in a marathon.
That's exactly the point of this film, is that violence goes hand in hand with their ability to be good athletes.
Yeah.
And Lee, if I could ask you, an issue that is raised in this documentary is that when you have a gun, you have a sense of power. So it seems as if it's an accepted reality or part of life in Kenya.
There's an amazing quote, and to be honest, it's the thing that probably stayed with me most from this film. I think it's Mutanda he's talking. He's like, you know, if you haven't killed someone, if you haven't stolen their property, then what kind of a warrior are you? And to me, this is really then what they're actually really trying to do online is change the whole paradigm of what makes a warrior or actually a man. And actually, that's something that is a huge, that's not just particular to this country, it's something we probably all need to look at in, you know, different societies, the way we construct masculine identity. And it shouldn't be about trying to dominate and power and, you know, impose yourself. And I think actually, they don't explore that anymore, sadly, I felt in this. Mm. But the fact that he vocalizes it shows that actually it's making him reconsider what, you know, as a warrior he should be doing. And then the fact that he goes into more sort of, you know, political and sort of socially constructive things is obviously helping that situation.
When I was in the bush, I used to run. That's why when I came here, I didn't find it difficult when I started to run. Because I was running even 100 kilometers. You know, when the police is chasing you, also you chase the cattle. So you chase very fast. But if you chase very slowly, the police will capture you, and then you'll be in a hot soup.
I found both characters to be quite endearing, but I think Mutanda was the more charismatic one out of the two. And we get the sense that he had a much darker past than Relay. There was a moment when he was asked how many people he's killed, and he just looks off camera and remains silent, which is quite chilling to watch. Lee, what did you make of Mutanda's character compared to Relay's?
Yeah, I mean, one of the strengths of the film is that they are very different. So you have that immediate contrast. And Tete's, you know, described it very well. Mutanda's the sort of more social, you know, political animal. He has a natural ability and affinity to kind of, you know, draw people in. Relay is much more kind of, you know, quieter, more sort of focused on his own sort of goals. And so that, I think, is one of the main strengths of the film, because as you follow their paths, you find that actually they diverge more than you might expect, because actually they aren't equally talented runners. So then one storyline really pursues the actual running side of it, and the other goes, I would say, into equally or maybe more interesting avenues about, well, if you can't do that, it's not just, you know, guns or running. Actually, if the running is not going to be your career, you can use your skills in different ways. And I think that's a very interesting.
And we see Mutanda pursue politics, but then of course we learned that it seems to be a corrupt world, and it's almost he embraces it and talks about it openly. Tete, is this a reality of life in Kenya?
It's a reality of life in Kenya, and not just Kenya, a lot of African countries. It's also the reality of life over here, but it's because there's a lot more wealth, and because ordinary people's needs are taken care of on a day-to-day basis, you don't see it as starkly. But in Kenya, it's very clear. I mean, he threatens the politician that if you don't make me, you know, minister in charge of security, which he patently won't be able to hold, he wouldn't be able to hold that position. He said he'd mobilize things against him. But what it says to me is that these individual talents are kind of drawn into this prism of organization, be it the sport, be it politics, be it whatever. And it is the quality of the organization that can absolutely, you know, enable them or absolutely destroy them.
And I want to touch quickly on the point about guns. We find out in this documentary also that there's 500,000 illegal guns in Kenya. I mean, where are they coming from and why are they there?
Well, I mean, there was a breakup of the Soviet Union, and that led to a huge kind of splurge of small arms all over the world. And, of course, these things are what are required to create kind of little lordships in all of these different countries. And it is one of the saddest statistics of African life that is that where there are the greatest resources, you have the greatest conflicts. So a country like the Congo, which is incredibly wealthy, has had internecine strife for near on 40 years consecutively. Of course, while that happens, the natives can't benefit from the resources in their land, but other agents do. And unfortunately, it is often foreign agents who enable these weapons to get into the hands of these people, and so that it's almost a system of divide and rule. But of course, you know, if you're a politician in Africa and you're accepting bribes from foreign agents to create conflict and strife in your own country, that's a decision only you can make. Nobody holds a gun to your head to do that. So it comes to issues around personal integrity and so on and so forth.
That's a really interesting point, but I'm afraid we'll have to move on just for the time being.
Dream about my future. Mostly I dream about money. I will build this, I will build that. Many things like that.
My name is Julius Arile from Kenya. 6 years ago, being a warrior, fighting with another people from our country. But this time now, I am an athlete and I can run a marathon.
He really does need to make a breakthrough. And if he doesn't have it, then it's going to be harder to fulfill this kind of dream of being in New York as an elite, top elite athlete that could maybe make it in the top five.
Good morning and welcome to Prague, Czech Republic, for the 19th running of the Volkswagen Prague Marathon.
A great race started in Prague's Old Town Square in this historic city.
So really is very much the underdog character in this documentary, and you really find yourself rooting for him. He has a lot of pressure on himself to prove himself, and he dreams of being on the wall, as he says, of all the top runners of Kenya. And we see him come seventh place in the first race, but then do really well in the second opportunity he has. What did you make of this sort of triumphant arc he had?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I guess when you're choosing your characters to focus on at the beginning of a journey, you have no idea, actually, are they going to make it? So I think it's less, it sounds a cliche, but it's less about the destination than the journey. It's fascinating to follow this particular man on his sort of athletics career. Now, if he, you know, ends up winning a gold medal at the Olympics, even more extraordinary. But actually, I find it more interesting when you see the real struggles and the person who isn't necessarily going to be the ultimate victor in this. The film really made me think about an American documentary called Hoop Dreams from the 1990s, which followed two young inner-city kids who wanted to be basketball stars. Now, neither of them end up making it, but what you get is a fascinating portrait of their environment and the world that they're in and the politics and the social disadvantages, and actually, that's a more illuminating and, I think, more fascinating storyline than just, you know, the underdog who comes from nowhere to, you know, in the last minute, you know, storms to the front and wins the medal. That's interesting, but I'm more interested in the sort of the world that shapes their, you know.
Of course, he's plagued by poverty and injuries and not the same opportunities. Tete, I see you agreeing with Lee there?
Yeah, but absolutely, the journey's fascinating. And none of these characters are pristine. Arile got somebody pregnant when she was quite young. It led to her suicide and led to him becoming a warrior. But later on, he's now got three wives and children by all of them. So if he's not able to take that, put each one of his problems in some kind of compartment, he won't be able to pursue his dream. So these dreams are always fraught. And actually, the story, as you say very well, is the compromises, you know, the calls that each person has to make to pursue what it is that they're really after, and an illumination of the environment within which all of this is going on.
I want to talk now about the parallels we see between Kenya and the US, sort of the Western world. Lee, what did you make of their journey, of Arile's journey to New York, and sort of the observations and comments he was making?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's very much sort of fish out of water stuff, right? So, you know, where they've grown up, where they live, what they're used to is obviously a world away from, you know, the slightly more glamorous, the more professional, the more kind of money at stake world that they go into. But I think, again, what's really interesting is in their own world as well, you see the way that they're not quite fitting in and the problems that they have. And to be honest, I would have liked the film to touch more on that. Like Tete says, they have these very checkered family lives. That's not really grappled with in the way that I would have, you know, appreciated a bit more. And I feel that, you know, of course the thread is the running and the marathon and what happens, but actually to get to know them even a bit more as characters and get a sort of a more rounded portrait of them, I would have liked to hear more about those sort of difficulties with the families and the wives and the kids, mm-hmm. because it obviously has an impact. He wants to earn money so he can go back mm-hmm. and provide for them, but we don't necessarily get, you know, the full story about what that entails.
And Tete, isn't it quite sad though that this notion of success, we see Arile move to sort of a shack-like accommodation and he thinks he's living in a European city. Why is that this connection of success is linked to Europe and the West?
Well, success is always relative to what you've got. I mean, this guy wasn't having three baths a week out in the bush, and he's suddenly in a shack with running water. I mean, that's luxury. He might as well, from his point of view, be at the Ritz Hotel. So it's absolutely relative. But what I think it's important for people to also think about is the fact that this can be quite corrupting. This kind of drive to live in that star-spangled environment can be quite corrupting, because we all know that the industry that he's now becoming a part of, the elite athletics industry, is also incredibly corrupt.
Which is mainly dominated, sort of, as we see, by Western physiotherapists and management types.
Sure. It's incredibly corrupt. So it's really a story about how, you know, man has to try and make it, making moral judgments at every turn of the way in a not-so-easy world.
Mm. I'm afraid we'll have to leave it there, gentlemen. Thank you very much for joining Doc Review. And that's it for this episode of Doc Review. Thank you to both my guests and to you. I've been Camila Shambayati.
Join us in this journey. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood ghodde saratani Israel mukhalifim.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel. Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Imam Hussein gave life and meaning to the day of Ashura, January 9th, 2010. All days of the year are essentially the same. It is human beings, their determination and selfless efforts that make certain days prominent and turn them into a flag to guide other people. Ashura, the 10th of Muharram, is not in itself different from other days. It was Imam Hussein who gave life and meaning to that day and raised its position. It was the selfless efforts of Hussein ibn Ali's companions that made Ashura so important. How valuable are ceremonies for mourning Imam Hussein's martyrdom? December 27, 2009. Some people may question the value of the ceremonies for mourning Imam Hussein's martyrdom. They may say, if you want to speak about Imam Hussein's movement, just go ahead and speak about his movement. Why all the crying? This is a wrong assumption. It will be extremely hard to move ahead on this path in the absence of this emotional connection to the infallible Imams. This sense of friendship is of paramount importance, and it can be achieved through this emotional connection to the infallible Imams. Narrating the tragedies that happened to them is an attempt to establish this emotional connection. Similarly, praising their virtues through the mourning ceremonies is another way to form this emotional bond. Therefore, it is necessary to hold the mourning ceremonies and narrate the events of Ashura.
Ana mazlum Hussein, ana mazlum Hussein, ana mazlum. أنا لا تشان
Imam Hussein, peace be upon him, made the army of reason overcome the army of ignorance.
أنا لا تشان أنا لا
Mourning ceremonies for Imam Hussein's martyrdom are great opportunities to promote Islam. December 13, 2009. Religious publicity in the month of Muharram is a case in point. The religious ceremonies for mourning Imam Hussein's martyrdom provide us with the best opportunity to promote Islam. We should utilize this opportunity in order to help distinguish right from wrong and create a beacon of guidance for the people. In the modern world, creating fitnas is the main technique that is used by the enemies of the truth. In such a situation, the proponents of the truth should provide the people with as much insight and clear guidance as they can so that they do not get confused.
NATO has just concluded its 17th annual arms control conference with harsh criticism directed towards authorities in Moscow, Beijing, Pyongyang, and Tehran. NATO, led by the United States, continues to spend billions on military hardware, but clearly does not like it when nations outside the alliance develop their own defense capabilities.
There are also other players fielding nuclear weapons and advanced missile systems. North Korea and Iran, for example, are blatantly ignoring or breaking the global rules.
Iran has always stressed its nuclear program is purely peaceful. In fact, Tehran did all in its power to reassure the international community by signing up to the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action in 2015. It was the United States under Donald Trump that illegally withdrew from that nuclear accord. Stoltenberg failed to mention this once during his speech. In any case, experts say NATO is not in a position to point the finger. There are significant divisions within the 30-nation alliance. Its credibility is currently at rock bottom, critics argue, following its 20-year-long mission in Afghanistan.
The European member states of NATO will need to come up with real arguments to demonstrate that NATO makes values. You need to demonstrate the return on investment.
The head of NATO, Jens Stoltenberg, concluded his address to the Arms Control Conference with these words.
You can count on NATO's commitment to security and stability.
That statement will likely cut to the bone for any Afghan citizen able to hear it. Anti-war campaigners say the destruction NATO countries brought to Afghanistan during the past two decades cannot be put into words. And now those Afghan civilians who somehow managed to survive have no idea what the future holds. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Palestinians in the Gaza Strip have celebrated the escape of six Palestinian inmates from Israeli maximum security Jabal prison in north of the occupied territories through a tunnel dug in the floor. Palestinians hailed the heroic operation and handed out candies to celebrate what they call a heroic move. Palestinian factions consider the escape as a slap in the face of the Israeli regime.
This operation is a great victory for our Palestinian prisoners, the resistance, and our Palestinian people. What happened in Jabal prison is unique. Our inmates grabbed their freedom by themselves, leaving the Israeli security defeated and confused. We are celebrating this victory as we call on all Palestinians to provide safety for those inmates.
Prisoners' groups said four of the inmates were serving life sentences. Another man was held under a special detention order, and the sixth was awaiting a verdict. Five of them belong to the Islamic Jihad movement, and one is a former commander in Fatah Party.
This escape has damaged the image of the Israeli regime before the world. It is such a great victory for Palestinians. We warn the Israeli regime against doing any action that puts the lives of those heroes at risk.
Palestinian resistance movements emphasized that the struggle for freedom with the Israeli occupation persists both behind bars and outside.
This is the biggest prison break in the history of the Palestinian cause, and it's going to be a remarkable incident in history. As Palestinian resistance, we hail these inmates' efforts of grabbing back their freedom and breaking the Israeli chains. We warn Israel not to hurt those prisoners, or else this will cost the Israeli regime a lot.
Palestinians have praised the heroic escape of the Palestinian inmates, describing it a blow to the Israeli regime and its security. They also stressed that the resistance is the only way to defend their rights and liberate their lands. Ruba Shabet, Gaza.
Voices of dissent outside Europe's biggest weapons fair, euphemistically called Defense and Security Equipment International, DSEI. More than 37,000 delegates descending on the British capital this year for a close encounter of the military kind, with more than 1,700 companies and dozens of governments here to buy or sell. Some are offering surveillance equipment, other manufacturers marketing all manner of lethal hardware, among them those who profited immensely from the so-called war on terror. The UK claims that it's leading the way in ethical arms sales.
We have a procedure that follows the consolidated criteria that is very clear around humanitarian law. We have in place a rigorous and robust process.
That is a claim dismissed by groups such as Stop the Arms Fair. They say by hosting the weapons show, Britain is perpetuating conflict and putting profit before human lives.
This arms fair wouldn't happen without the UK's support, the government's support, the defence and security exports team of the government makes sure that this arms fair happens. They know that human rights abusing countries are coming here to buy weapons that are made by UK companies and also foreign companies that we host in our country. Campaigner.